Everybody, and welcome to our weekly To Know Insights call on the impact of COVID-19. The economic impact of coronavirus is centre stage today, with Rishi Sunak about to announce a major stimulus package against a backdrop of high-profile business failures and job losses. There'll be a stamp duty holiday on the first £500,000 of houses, a £2 billion kickstart scheme for jobs for young people, a £3 billion scheme to cut emissions. And Treasury figures have told me to expect plenty more, including what they call big bazookas in the autumn statement. But while economics today, there's a growing horror story in parts of the world where the virus is proving ever more devastating. As ever, it's the poorest who are suffering most, and many are saying President Trump's decision to pull out of the World Health Organization is disastrous. Do we have the capacity and the bandwidth to help or do anything about it? We've got the perfect panel today to talk about all of this. Richard Curtis is the writer and director of some of our best-loved films and TV series. Not content with that, he's also had a huge impact on international aid as a founder of Comic Relief. We're doubly privileged to have him today because he tells me he has shave and no shave days according to the company he keeps, and today is a shave day. Claire Perry-O'Neill is a former business minister for energy and industrial strategy. She'll discuss government plans to boost business and the economy and if this can be done in a green way too. David Isaac is a leading lawyer and chair of the Equality and Human Rights Commission. He'll offer his perspective on the response of business and organisations to COVID-19 and BAME equality campaigns. And Danny Srishkandaraja is the CEO of Oxfam GB. He can offer a humanitarian perspective on the crisis and the work of Oxfam in response. But before we start, the usual housekeeping points. Please keep yourself on mute throughout the call. If you drag your cursor to the top right-hand side of the screen, you can see the chat function. Please send your questions here, and I'll put them to the panel in the second half of the call. And for legal reasons, I have to say if there are any journalists on the call, please hang up now. This isn't intended for broadcast or publication in any way. So that done, let's get to it. Richard Curtis, let's start with you. With all that's going on, it's hard to raise our sights and see the impact of COVID and our behaviours on others around the world. Tell us about how you see that and what you're trying to do about it.
Thank you very much for your introduction. I had a terrible moment last night. Thank you for mentioning that I used to write things. I've never managed to convince my girlfriend to watch an episode of Blackadder for some reason. And last night she said, I know lots of your friends have read it, so I don't think I need bother. So she doesn't even know it's a TV show, which is very demoralizing. Look, we are living through a really tragic time. And in some ways, to think of it as an opportunity is a peculiar thing to do. So I'm very aware of how, you know, all our experiences are different. But as an advocate for the SDGs, we were going to have a big year this year in 2020, because it's 5 years since the SDGs took off. And that's now been, you know, really in some ways delayed. But I do think that the, you know, UN's new motto in this turn of phrase, Build Back Better, which is becoming so popular, that there is a sort of psychologically important moment that we've now seen that the worst can happen. As coronavirus, you know, takes over New York, suddenly the possibility that major cities will be flooded if we don't do something about coronavirus strikes one as being, you know, true rather than untrue. So I think that it's never been more important for people to think about the long-term vision of their business, the, you know, and the long-term results of our behaviors. And in the middle of this, you know, it does seem to be that business is completely crucial. I remember sitting with the Secretary General and him saying the big surprise of the SDGs is that the most passionate, enthusiastic, and practical endorsers of it have been businesses. Which is such a contrast to when I did Make Poverty History in 2005, when we couldn't get business people to talk to us at all. So I increasingly think of business as being the necessary heroes for the next 10 years, the people that, because they've got the money, the jobs, the ability to plan long term, the supply chains, all of these things which will make such a difference. You know, I'm very glad to be in the company of these future heroes and forms of CEOs. And I would say that my experience over the last few years, you know, talking to people like Paul Polman and Mark Benioff, you do see the fire in the eyes of business people who have, you know, committed to these issues and how often and practically they feel it can apply. But, you know, I think you all know this. The thing I'd love to talk about today is a really practical thing about pensions. I've always been obsessed by how you fund the changes that the world needs, you know, and I started a charity because I thought that was the way. And then we did Live 8 because I felt that putting pressure on governments to spend their money in different ways was the way. I still believe very strongly in those things. But if you are going to turn the billions into trillions that is necessary to sort of fulfill the SDGs, it is going to be business and an investment that does it. And there is just this huge thing that our aid budget is 15 billion and our pension pot is 3.1 trillion. So, you know, there's the money to be able to apply and support businesses that are doing best on climate, that are doing best on diversity, that are doing best on gender, all the really exciting things, you know, affordable housing, affordable medicine, discovering vaccines, renewable energy, all of these things are there for pension pots to invest in. And a lot of people think that if we have a campaign, and our campaign is called Make My Money Matter, that it's bound to be sort of divestment. And I do think that's, you know, a very interesting emotional trigger. Vegans don't want to invest in meat production. People fighting against smoking don't want to invest in cigarette companies. But I think the big cultural change that I'm sensing is a sort of consumer revolution about the way that we can get involved day to day in the way we change the world. So I think my kids and young people I talk to, they're looking at the amount they fly, the clothes they buy, the food they buy. And I'm trying to say that the money they invest is an absolutely key trigger into how you can make a difference in the world. So, you know, my appeal would be that everyone on this call just goes back and looks at their company pension scheme. It's a hugely popular thing. You know, all research seems to say, I think 62% of people would want their investments to be aligned with what they believe in. You know, 50%, over 50% of people would assume and want the default pension to actually be ESG consistent and be sustainable. I mean, I think it's a really popular thing to do inside a company. And I think employees are going to be demanding it, and employees want to be passionate about the good things that their companies do. And the things that worried me most no longer seem to be true. I've got a statistic here, which is, yeah, BlackRock have just said that 94% of ESG funds have done better during COVID than the ones that haven't. And 70 billion has gone into the sustainable market and 200 million has gone out. So even though, and it's also just simple returns, just for the normal pension person, the chances are that if you have an ethical and sustainable pension, it'll do better. So suddenly that thing of is it value versus values, I don't think any longer applies. So, you know, I would just say that this is a real good opportunity for employees to see their company doing something which really shows commitment to sustainability, commitment to the environment. It's going to be a complicated thing to do because everything to do with money is complicated. But the more that we work on it, the less complicated it'll be, the more pensions see it actually as a marketing opportunity to get people to put in more and to get more clients. The more that businesses say this is what we want, the government will actually try and, you know, move legislation so that trustees don't feel, of pension funds don't feel that their responsibility is only towards, as it were, the shareholders, but it's also towards the people and the planet. There's such a huge logic in this. No one wants a slightly higher pension in a world on fire. So I just would love to say that if, you know, there's a spare half hour in people's days tomorrow to just put in a call to financial officers, find out where your business pension is, check whether or not there's a better one, whether all these young people who, when they come and start working for you, it'll be one of the first questions that they ask. And it's just one of the ways of post-COVID making sure that we have a consistent aptitude, possibility, and the money to invest in all the best businesses that are doing the best things ethically that will be the most successful. Risk now lies in things like we're seeing with Boohoo today, companies that will get knocked all the value off the company because they're doing the wrong thing. So ethical companies are safer and doing more for the planet. So my job today is not to be idealistic, as it were, but to be functional and ask everyone to look into their pensions, because I think it'll be a popular and, you know, deeply benign thing for the world.
Well, thank you, Richard. You're certainly talking to the right people. And at the end of this call, when we send around the notes, we'll send a link to Make My Money Matter so that people can really have a look at that and explore that. Danny, as CEO of Oxfam GB, you're very natural to fit off the back of this. How are you finding COVID-19 is affecting donations to you? And you must be seeing it exacerbating a lot of the problems that you're normally dealing with.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's, I mean, maybe I'll start with the second, which is just the sort of world that we work in. You know, Oxfam's operational in 90 odd countries around the world. And I think, you know, it might seem surprising to some that the virus hasn't quite had the impacts that many people thought it would have in parts of the developing world. You know, so this was very much seen as a Chinese disease, then a European disease, and then a North American disease. And the numbers in parts of the developing world in terms of infections or deaths haven't yet risen. And I think the, I mean, a couple of observations from where we sit. I mean, first is that those numbers are now starting to rise. You can see the dramatic rise in Brazil. You can see that India is now projecting a peak in the next few weeks. And this will be a global pandemic. And those countries where the health systems and sort of the public societal infrastructure is just weak are really going to suffer. So, you know, already the WHO's prediction is that more people will die in Africa, for example, by the end of the year than they have in North America, but that the disease will sort of manifest in different ways. But for us, the really worrying things about the sort of context that we're working in is the secondary impacts, the non-health impacts, because, you know, the lockdowns and other measures being taken to restrict the spread of the disease are having a hugely profound impact on the lives and livelihoods of some of the poorest people around the world. So, you know, in Europe and North America, we've managed in some ways because governments have been able to pump huge amounts of income directly into our pockets or to support businesses. Many of us have savings, and we're also working, you know, with a reasonably functioning economy and supply chain. But if you're in a slum in Nairobi and you're in the informal economy, and all of a sudden you're in lockdown and you don't have access to your form of income, plus you don't have savings to draw on, your state isn't willing or able to provide you with any meaningful support, you can't grow your own crops, you're facing extreme hunger. And in fact, this was brought home to me very clearly a few weeks ago when a taxi driver who texted a colleague of mine at Oxfam and said, "This virus will starve us before it infects us." And that is happening. You know, in fact, tomorrow we have a report we'll be publishing called The Hunger Virus, in which we estimate the number of additional people who will die this year as a result of lockdowns in some of the poorest parts of the world. And the numbers are staggering. You know, they will match, if not exceed, the numbers of people who will die as a direct result of being infected by the virus. And so this is a humanitarian crisis. It's of a scale that we haven't seen before. It isn't exactly as we might have predicted it a few months ago, because I think we were all imagining that this would be lots of people in hospitals dying. But in fact, what's happening is it's lots of people in refugee camps, in urban slums, who are suffering and who are dying and who are having their livelihoods disrupted. So in terms of the sort of the work of charities like us, it feels sort of more timely than ever before. We also had an estimate recently where we're suggesting that 500 million more people will be pushed into poverty as a result of coronavirus pandemic in the medium term. And that will reverse some of those, you know, really important gains the world has made on poverty reduction in the last few decades. And Richard and others have been so integrally part of that campaign. And that's a tragedy, you know, just as we should be entering, you know, the remainder of the 21st century, having, you know, expecting to eradicate extreme poverty, 500 million more people may be pushed into it. And of course, you know, the economic impacts of COVID are likely to be long term, especially for those middle income countries in the developing world who've relied on being plugged into the global economy to achieve some of that poverty reduction. So if you're a trading nation or if you're a nation that's been relying on tourism, it's unlikely that the global trade environment or your tourism market is going to recover anywhere near quickly enough in order for you to restore your economic health to where it was. And that's going to have profound impacts on hotel workers or farmers and agricultural workers, garment workers all around the world. But just to your first part of your question, Craig, of course, the paradox for us and almost every charity everywhere in the world is our services are more needed than ever before, whether that's in the humanitarian context or just in terms of supporting communities here in the UK, you know, being part of the social fabric of our communities and supporting each other. Just at this time, our ability to sustain ourselves is harder than ever before. So in our case, we as Oxfam have had a huge hit because our 600 shops across the country have been closed for about 3 months, and that's cost us about £15 million or so, and all of that has come straight off our reserves. As a sector, we think charities in the UK have lost about £4 billion worth of income over this last few months since COVID disruption began. And that's because, you know, for the bigger charities like us, it means we can't, you know, benefit from Glastonbury or the London Marathon or other fundraising events. It's also because people can't do the sort of face-to-face fundraising that they might do otherwise. Donations, though, from supporters happily have stayed fairly consistent and in some ways grown. But that might be, you know, we worry, a short-term phenomenon because people still do have access to income, still do care. And perhaps we're talking in the case of Oxfam, you know, we've got several hundred thousand people who give to us regularly. They're probably the sort of core internationalists who, you know, who are worried about what's happening in the UK, but who are also really worried about what's happening abroad. But I worry, you know, as society recovers, you know, Britain has this wonderful tradition of a very strong civil society, amazing charities. COVID is going to do some really deep damage to civil society here in the UK.
That's fascinating, Danny. And some of those numbers of the £4 billion is not going to charities, it's quite a staggering number. Claire, I'm going to come to you next. It sort of might feel like a bit of a crunching gear change to bring it back to domestic politics and economics today. But it is really related to a lot of what Richard and Danny have been saying, really, isn't it? Because it's like the money is draining out. That stops our ability to necessarily help overseas, makes it perhaps more focused on what's going on in the UK. Can you tell us about what you think the government's doing today and the effects of that?
Yes, and you're right, Craig. I mean, we've had the UK has historically had a leadership position both in the decarbonisation agenda and in the overseas development agenda. And so it is really relevant to say, you know, what are the domestic priorities? Well, all eyes are going to be on Rishi Sunak's second phase COVID response statement, which will start in about 40 minutes. And we've seen a couple of the announcements, as you said. I just wanted to delve in slightly. I mean, the government's obsessed, rightly, I think, with stopping unemployment spiking up to the 15% levels that the OECD said that it could. It's just as a reminder, it's about 4% now. That's still, you know, 40-year historic lows, but 9 million people are being supported by the incredibly expensive furlough scheme. So how do you take away that support in a way that doesn't put millions of people out of work, and particularly young people for whom the long-term impact of being out of work, we know, can be quite devastating. So really good to see this kickstart scheme being announced. It's quite generous. It's about £6,000 per worker age 16 to 24. But as we know, these things are much easier to announce than to implement. And in fact, I remember coming into office in 2010 and we scrapped something quite similar called the Future Jobs Fund because it didn't really create new jobs and it wasn't focusing on sort of the skills for the future. So there's some really welcome stuff in the outline of the scheme that suggests it will be a better scheme. But I think there are huge opportunities for employers in the UK to get involved, to shape the scheme, to actually think about creatively how they can use what is effectively a big transfer of funds for a particularly disadvantaged group of the workforce. And then the second thing, I was the Minister for Energy and Clean Growth who brought in the net zero legislation. So I get asked a lot about, you know, what are the green motivations of this government? And it was really good to see the pre-announcement, if you like, of this £3 billion energy efficiency scheme. Housing energy efficiency is an unbelievably boring topic, if you like, for many governments, but it's absolutely essential. The UK has got a very old and energy efficient housing stock. So very good to see some grant money going into that. People will remember the Green New Deal, which was a hugely complicated thing attempting to try and have the same impact, but it was a loan scheme that wasn't very appealing. But just a couple of notes of caution. So £3 billion in total being committed as grants. The intention is to get that spent ASAP. There are some challenges in doing that, one of which is it's quite hard to get people to do this stuff, as we know. We all sit around saying, yes, next year I'll insulate my loft or website. And, you know, in order to get the UK's net zero 50, you need to spend four times as much as this every year for the next 29 years. So this is a drop in the ocean. And of course, governments, much easier for governments to express their legislation.
Claire, I'm just going to slightly interrupt you there a second, just to remind people to go on mute, because we've got somebody who seems to be scratching.
They're clearly taking lots of notes as I speak.
They are. But anyway, please go on mute. But Claire, please continue.
Thank you. I just wanted to point out in France, which has committed 15 billion euros so far to a green stimulus, President Macron is talking about a new law to be passed in 2021 that mandates homeowners have to upgrade the energy efficiency of their homes to a higher level before they can sell their house. So a bit of stickism as well as some carrotism, which I think is actually going to be required. But, you know, we are not talking about a couple of really important things today because we're so focused on unemployment and the stimulus package. And one is the NHS, which, you know, is off the front pages for the first time in months. And a couple of things I think that are bubbling away under the surface that I'm picking up in Westminster. The first is, you know, we have spent a phenomenal amount of money on PPI procurement, £15 billion on emergency spending, and some real questions being raised about has that money been wisely spent. And secondly, the topic of excess deaths is bubbling along. You know, people who have not been engaging with the health service because of the COVID crisis. And as those numbers start to rise and those stories start to come out, this provides a perfect platform for the new leader of the Labour Party, who has been remarkably consistent in his support for the government during the COVID crisis, to start to create some clear blue water in the treatment and nourishment of the NHS, historically the Conservatives' weak point and the Labour Party's strong point. Oh, and by the way, you're now starting to also see demands for public sector pay increases because of the concerns around the NHS. And this gets me back to a final and closing point, which is today's statement is the sort of appetizer, if you like, for the autumn budget, where we be expecting Rishi Sunak to set out serious tax and spend calculations and serious long-term policy implications of what the government's doing. And remember that although we talk about the government as having an 80-seat majority, many of those new MPs who were elected in former Labour seats, according to recent polling, think a lot more like a new Labour MP than they do a traditional low-tax, low-spend Tory MP. So balancing those challenges of delivering on the manifesto, being a populist government supporting the country, but also trying to deal with this internal tension of the kind of low tax, low spend traditional Tories and the new, more interventionist wing of the party, I think is going to prove really difficult running up to the autumn statement. That's when the calculators need to come out and some serious questions need to be asked.
Thank you, Claire. The fourth member of our panel is David Isaac, who's the chair of the Equality and Human Rights Commission. You can't actually see him at the moment because technology's defeated us at the moment. But David, I believe you're on the phone. Can I just check that you're there now?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me?
I can hear you. The last few months has been notable not just for the huge impact of COVID, but we've also seen us looking at equality, the issue of equality after the George Floyd murder in the United States. And it's perhaps made us look at equality and think, are we as advanced as we perhaps thought we were? I wonder if you could just give us a few thoughts about that, particularly in the light of what we've been hearing from the other panelists.
Absolutely. And thank you very much for inviting me this morning. And I'm sorry you can't see me. I'm in my best work jumper, so you're spared that. But clearly there are lots of challenges, and colleagues have already talked about the importance of climate change. I'm a technology lawyer when I'm not the chair of the Equality and Human Rights Commission. And I think we all know that we've seen more changes in the way technology is used by us all in the last 3 months than in the last 5 years. And I also think when we look up at the skies, we take some pleasure in the fact that they're not cluttered, and the role of business in actually committing to cut down on business travel is going to be an important contributor. But for me, the third key issue that we all face is the importance of delivering greater equality. And for the reasons that you mentioned, Craig, I think we're at a real turning point. I think at the start of the crisis, we all congratulated ourselves that actually the virus doesn't discriminate. But actually, we know that that's sadly not the case, because the greatest impact has actually fallen on BAME communities, but also the most vulnerable in terms of disabled and older people. And it's not just socioeconomic factors which have actually contributed to those things. It's the way in which we know that there are significant underlying issues that we all face, whether it's in relation to racism, but also the way in which there is a lot of discrimination. And that clearly has resulted in a huge call for action by younger people in particular, but I think not just younger people. And the murder of George Floyd obviously brought that to everybody's attention around the globe, but it's translated back into the inequalities that we see back at home. As I say, the Equality and Human Rights Commission has been pointing out some of the underlying inequalities that exist in relation to education, criminal justice, and in other areas, particularly in relation to education, for quite some time. And we've been calling upon the government to develop a coherent strategy and to build upon some of the recommendations. And indeed, there are many, many recommendations. But I'm keen on this call, for the short time that I have everybody's attention, to talk about the role of business. I read in the FT a statement by Ben Okri, which really resonated with me, about how lockdown has purified our sense of justice. And that was before the death of George Floyd, and before I think we understood the impact of some of the underlying issues for BAME communities because of the virus. As EHRC chair, what I know, and I'm a partner in a city law firm, is that the role of business in driving change is hugely important. And I'm always amused that the public sector is subject to the public sector equality duty. And of course, the business world and the private sector isn't. And I believe that we've made as much, if not more, progress in the private sector without the public sector equality duty, perversely, than the public sector absolutely has achieved. And what I'd like to end up focusing on is just some practical issues for you as board members, CEOs, or future CEOs, in relation to what you can do, because I think there are a number of really very easy practical steps. Many of these things have already been put into practice by businesses, but actually we need a lot more action. And that means that we need to start with leadership from CEOs and from boards. Some of the progress I think we congratulate ourselves on, but as I say, it isn't sufficient. So in practical terms, I think we need more senior black and minority ethnic executives and board members. My plea this morning is that we need to stop talking about how we develop the pipeline. The pipeline actually exists. What we need to do is to provide more support for talented black and minority ethnic candidates who need to have opportunities to learn, to gain experience, to shadow, to act up, because it's only by that means will they be confident enough to apply for jobs, and that boards and senior execs will be confident enough to appoint them. But let's not talk about how we need to spend 5 to 10 years building up the pipeline. My second point is about how we need to collect the data. A lot of data already exists. Businesses are quite good at collecting data, but only by looking at the detail of the data and moving beyond the categorization of black and minority ethnic, because we know that you can break that down, and Asians do much more effectively than British black people. will we actually get to the bottom of how we address these issues? I would urge you to measure and disclose your ethnicity pay gap. The Commission leads on the gender pay gap, and we regulate it, and it's actually created a huge national debate about gender pay, and we need to do the same in relation to ethnicity pay gaps, because whether it's in relation to the provision of data or the transparency that pay gap reporting provides, we will, I think, be shocked by what we find, and it will, in fact, lead to a huge call for action and, I think, a responsibility for boards to take appropriate steps. And I think we need to set ambitious targets and make boards and CEOs personally responsible for those things. And the final point is the legal mechanisms exist to actually use positive action. Businesses and indeed the public sector are always very cautious about using these tools, but it's easy to use them without falling foul of, you know, what is considered to be positive discrimination. It means using schemes to provide support and mentoring, but also in a situation where there are two equal candidates, you can actually positively discriminate in favor of the diverse candidate. And my final point is about how this isn't just the right thing to do because it addresses inequality in our country. There's an enormously positive business case here. We know that if all BAME candidates, and I use BAME very deliberately, are allowed to contribute and are fully utilized in our economy, then that would add an extra £24 billion to our economy, which, given all of the challenges that exist today, would be a significant amount. And I would urge you to take these positive steps before the tsunami of unemployment kicks in this autumn. So happy to take questions when we get to that particular point, but thank you.
David, thank you very much. And as ever, look, there was a huge amount of ground to cover there. I suppose one theme that just keeps coming through in all these calls is, have people's behaviours and values shifted during this? And I'd like to put that to each of you in turn, starting with you, Richard. I remember, you know, when you started all of this a while back, it was very much, please donate some money. And now it's increasingly moving towards activism, and you've seen changes in the way that the likes of Global Citizen, that kind of thing, your new Make My Money Matter thing is about changing your behaviour, that kind of thing, not donating. Has this accelerated that?
I mean, I feel it. I think it absolutely has. I mean, I think it is very interesting, you know, how the Me Too movements and the Black Lives Matter movement are, you know, seriously making people look at their behavior both at home and at work. You know, it's certainly a very interesting discussion between myself and the younger people that I've been locked down with, and it's the one where I'm most convinced I'm, as it were, wrong and on the wrong side of history. So I think, I can't really talk. It'd be interesting for sort of Danny to say what he thinks are the behavioral things, you know, which will make the most difference around the world. But I do think that people are now, as consumers and as people living their normal lives, you know, activism falls into two parts. You get, as it were, kids going out onto the streets and worrying about the environment. But then they think, well, what am I doing about that? And what are my parents doing about that? On the pension thing, I wrote a little sketch which we were going to film, which was a father having a very serious talk with his daughter who was just about to get a job, saying, you must make sure you get a pension. And then 2 weeks later, the daughter having a very serious talk with the father, saying, where's your pension invested? Is it actually doing any good, or is it going to harm our world? So I do think that people are going to think that the sort of communality of the COVID experience, I think, is going to make people, in a strange way, feel more involved in how they tie into the world rather than just to their own families and their own jobs. So I think that there is a shift, and I think certain doors are opening, which, if the right people, like the people on this call, push, can't be closed. I think the environmental thing keeps moving in the right direction. You know, I think that over the last few years, we've really seen people understand that the environment isn't only about polar bears and trees. It's about human beings, human suffering, human cost, business cost, all of those kind of things. So I think that in some ways the SDGs have reached their moment, which is their observation that you can't have justice without fixing the environment, without fixing equality, without fixing poverty. And I think that link, I mean, it's interesting, when I did Make Poverty History, we did not deliberately include climate because we thought that was such a confusing thesis. And I do think that people are now understanding the environment, business, morality of behavior, consumer power, all of these things are much more linked.
So Danny, this shift towards activism, particularly in the sort of NGO charity sector, I mean, you need money to help people, you need money to keep the lights on. Is it a good thing? And are you seeing yourself shift more towards activism, or is it actually give us some money and we'll spend it in the right places?
No, I think there's a definite shift towards activism because this is the moment it feels for systemic change, you know, whether that's behavioral change, whether it's about sort of the institutions globally working more effectively. And we can deliver some of that through the programs we run, but we can also deliver a lot of that through the advocacy and influencing work. And, you know, for one of the reasons I joined Oxfam was it was founded with that dual purpose from its very get-go. In 1942, the founders of Oxfam did two things. They wrote a check to the Greek Red Cross to provide famine relief in Greece, but they also wrote letters to the Prime Minister to change British policy on total war and what it was doing in Nazi-occupied Europe. And it's that twin role of civil society at its best that I think we need to go back to. And I'm optimistic also for the reasons Richard was talking about, that this surely has to be a moment that will bring us together as a world. You know, no one is safe from this pandemic until everyone is safe. And that's becoming abundantly clear. It's hard for us to get that message across. You know, Craig, you mentioned at the top of this call about the US decision to pull out of the WHO or reduce funding. You know, our country director in Yemen tells me that the Yemeni hospitals and clinics, which are, you know, in an atrocious state because of the state of war in that country, have had to reduce by 80% the payments they make to doctors and nurses who staff that system, because it was the WHO funding that was paying for those people to come into work, because the Yemeni government or state just doesn't have the resources to do so. Now, because that they've had to do that because of US, the direct impacts of the US withdrawing funding from the WHO. So, you know, here we have a global pandemic where, you know, if we, you know, keeping Yemenis safe and healthy is in our collective interest. But unless we really do get better at working together, we're asking for collective trouble. And I think there is a really big prize here in trying to sort of underline our communality or interconnectedness in this sort of globalized world.
And Claire,
Can I just jump in, Craig, just to say one thing there, just in terms of government and business, that as much as Danny and I would love governments to listen to charities, they do listen to business more. And it's an incredible, I do think the time for sort of modesty when you do the right thing and when you want things to change with business is over. I do think we're absolutely depending on business to become activists, on business to say, this is what we're doing. We need the legislative support. We need the financial support. You're not going to have a thriving business community without doing the right thing. I think it is, as it were, really time for CEOs who would believe in these things to talk to governments about these things, because they listen to you more than they listen to people who they can put in a box of, as it were, low paid campaigners. They need to hear from people who are doing very well, who have done very well, who are creating jobs, who are creating profit, actually to say, we also believe that this is done through justice and environmental consistency and sustainable and ethical behavior. Business is such an important communicator of these issues to people in power.
And Claire, this government was elected, seen quite right wing, quite interested in sort of charity begins at home, maybe not so interested in engaging internationally. We've seen what's happening with DFID, the Department for International Development. Do you think COVID has actually forced them to shift? I mean, what Rishi Sunak's about to do is a dramatic shift normal Conservative government would have done. But do you think they're much more open to these kind of arguments because of what's happened? Claire, I think you're on mute.
Thank you. I would like to think that. I'd actually divide the world into governments, consumers, and the business sector, corporates. And from a scorecard perspective, I'd give the UK government, and in fact most governments around the world, a sort of C in terms of getting to this systemic change. In fact, I think we've seen quite a retreat from multilateralism certainly in the climate space, certainly since the high point of the Paris Agreement. And COVID has definitely amplified that. You're seeing countries work alone rather than together in very many, many places. From a consumer point of view, I mean, Richard is right that you have an activist, a rise in activism, but we've also had a tsunami of single-use plastic that's emerged as a result of COVID. Nobody talks about the fact that, you know, rivers and streams are being clogged up by discarded masks and aprons. And, you know, 2 years ago, we were all busy working out how we could eliminate plastic completely from the supply chain. And we've actually, as consumers, I think, become rather lazy and rather selfish. That, you know, the striking rise in the number of people who got reported to the police for having barbecues in their back gardens in the UK suggests perhaps we're not being kinder and gentler. But I absolutely emphasize what both Danny and Richard have said about this activism in the business sector. I've talked to many CEOs about the climate and sustainability agenda, both inside and outside government, and with almost no exceptions, companies are not backpedaling on their commitments. They're actually taking the opportunity to change how they think about their own systems, business travel being the obvious one, as was mentioned. But they're doubling down, if you like, you know, particularly companies that are cash flow positive, on saying, right, we know we need a net zero target. What's the governance and investment structure for that? And how are we going to engage with those sustainability measures, particularly those that work for us? And Richard's quite right. We've seen overnight, and it, you know, a collapse of a very successful fast fashion brand over this problem with its supply chain. So whether it's onshoring supply chains, shortening supply chains, reducing water usage, reducing plastics usage, working on a net zero sector deal, I'm really sensing that desire of business to go further and faster. And, you know, as other comments have been made, as a former business minister, what you want ideally is a business sector to come to you and say, if you will tweak these particular things, we will absolutely deliver. And we did a lot of that through our various sector deals. You know, I'm encouraging the government to get back to listening to some of those business sectors who were often, and actually we saw this with COVID, the business response, whether it was through keeping workforces safe or procuring PPE, was in many cases weeks ahead of governments and done far more efficiently and far more effectively. So this is the time, I think, for the global corporate sector to really step up and say, we are going full steam ahead with our decarbonisation sustainability plans. And governments, we need you to come with us through the following particular things. And don't be shy in lobbying for what you need. Carbon pricing, carbon border tax adjustments, those are exactly where we need to be going, I think, in order to deliver this decarbonisation we have to have.
And David, I was interested in the number that you used. You were saying that there could be a £24 billion boost to the economy if people were more positively discriminating, really, in terms of employing people, that kind of thing. Can you just unpack that and explain that, why that would work for businesses and why how you come up with that number?
Certainly I can. But before I do that, just to echo what my colleagues have been saying, because I think we need to move beyond the rhetoric of us all being in this together to identify the role of business, picking up on Claire's point about how business leaders need to advocate more. We need to move into action here. And I think the business community is quite articulate already, but I think we need to continue to articulate further and be very specific and hold government to account. In relation to the 24 billion, I mean, clearly it's a big number, and I haven't got time to go into how it breaks down in detail. But you know, these are estimations of how at all levels in the private and the public sector, if people are able to fulfill their potential and operate at all levels within business without discrimination, the contribution to the economy is actually huge. What we've got is often real tokenism. You know, we've seen it in the past in relation to gender, and we know with the gender pay gap what the figures that we need to spend are to address that. In relation to ethnicity, they're even more significant, but actually we all benefit from actually training and involving people who've got huge potential, lots of different perspectives, and actually a different life experience, which will enrich us all, I believe.
Okay. Richard and Danny, I was talking to somebody the other day who said privately they felt unable to say this, but the reality is that we're going to be fighting against mass unemployment in this country. Businesses have got to make money in order to survive. And it's all very well saying this kind of thing, but the focus has to be on keeping themselves afloat before they get to these things. What would you say to somebody who was making that case, starting with you, Richard?
Well, clearly it's an absolutely huge question, and we don't know what is coming. I mean, how much did it cost to set up the NHS in 1945? Because Britain must have been in an incredibly difficult position financially, but they did an extraordinary thing, which has been massively to the benefit of this country ever since then. And that was a huge, unexpected and lateral result of a time of total crisis. So all I would say is I think that there is a precedent. And when I was I went to a meeting, a scary meeting at the Guildhall, I think in January, and I heard business leader after business leader saying that sustainability was the biggest possible sort of investment and business explosion since the Industrial Revolution. So that can't no longer be true. And I just think that it's a lot for long-term planning and thinking if we make this change now as we're making changes, as it were, then that will eventually lead to things ending up better. So that's my optimistic view of it, that, if you're a long-term, if you're looking at it in the long-term, now is the time to make the changes. So if you're, as it were, squeezing your employees, make sure that you leave in place those who are, don't cut those departments that would make the most difference in terms of having a sustainable and ethical business.
And Danny, what case would you make to government that's saying, look, we've just got to actually focus on ourselves and the economy for the moment?
I think so. Britain has there's a strong business case for a sort of positive values-based internationalism, not just as a sort of building back better from COVID, but also as Britain navigates the post-Brexit world. This country's sort of economic history has been so deeply intertwined with the rest of the world. And I think its economic future is going to be similarly. And there's a sort of interesting leadership opportunity, which is around soft power. It's around the role of charities like ours. It's not by accident that Britain is home to so many of these sort of key internationalist figures, or why Make Poverty History began in Britain. It's that tradition of a strong internationalism that I think we need to preserve, not just because it's the right thing to do, but I think it holds the key to our economic future as well. And that includes green leadership. And what a great opportunity that COP will present for Britain to show that positive leadership, which will have tangible economic impacts here, as well as all of the other benefits.
And Claire and David, another sort of dark thing that we can all, I suspect everybody on this call will largely agree, but another dark thing is that populism is there for a reason. Governments get elected, like Trump in the States, who do things like get rid of WHO, or the current government who sort of merged DFID into the Foreign Office, or what's going on in lots of other countries. It's there for a reason, because a lot of people feel nervous and worried. How do you react to that? And I'll come to you, David, in a second on that.
Well, I think it's a really interesting question. I mean, I personally think the DFID-FCO merger, if done properly, is not a retrograde step. If it is absolutely right to combine your soft power influence, which does include the extraordinary ambassadorial network and advisory network the UK has, with promotion of economic opportunities, both in the countries overseas and also at home. I mean, particularly on the innovation space and in the green space. So if it's done properly and it's done for the right reasons, it's not a regressive step. I think you have to be smart. So, we talk a lot about the world retreating. One of the big challenge in climate, I mean, yes, it's really good to insulate British homes, but you know, the UK is less than 1% of global emissions. We have a very important leadership role to play. We've got to get the world off coal-fired energy generation if we're going to have any hope of tackling this problem. And in the first 3 months of this year, China approved more coal-fired generation capacity than the whole of last year. So how do we deal with that? So conversations about border tax, carbon border tax adjustments are a way of actually making those supply chains greener. And oddly, they're quite appealing to populist governments, because what potentially you're doing is providing a leg up for your own industries who have decarbonized a long time ago. So I think there are ways to bring those two things together. But I think one of the tests of the UK government will be this commitment to internationalism from a development and a trade point of view. And so far, we've heard about the closure of DFID. We haven't heard much about what that future focus looks like. And Danny's right to point to the COP, which I was the president for, president designate for 6 months. We're going to really struggle without the business community to deliver a real breakthrough at COP26, because actually, unless you can get China and India at the table, really prepared to decarbonize, and not a huge amount of evidence that we're engaging with those countries on that topic yet, we're going to really struggle to deliver anything from a government to government perspective.
David, just on this point, the truth is a lot of what you are suggesting is going to make a lot of people nervous and fearful, and going back to this populism point, do you worry about that?
I do worry, because obviously what I find as chair of the Equality and Human Rights Commission is that this is a very polarized debate. There are lots of people who are very anxious because they see the advancement of equality as a zero-sum gain, and that clearly is not the case. Advancing some groups' rights doesn't necessarily diminish those of others, and in a way, that's the opportunity that COVID presents. As you know, we move beyond, I guess, the rhetoric of us all being in this together to look at the detail, because some of this takes time, some of it takes a lot of resource, but actually, it's about building upon the empathy that existed during the crisis. Picking up your point about whether it's the economy or people, well, actually, it's not binary, and we need to move to a situation where people understand the detail, that even people who are angry need to be heard. But that actually means engaging with the sorts of initiatives that we're talking about, which, quite frankly, advance the rights of white working class boys in the same way that they advance the rights of, you know, young Muslim girls. So my plea is for government to look beyond, the high level rhetoric of another outing on culture wars, and actually providing, some leadership, and really building upon some of the other things that others have talked about. The role of business, because I think business has done a lot, and actually this is integral to the success of building back, dare I say, better.
Okay, we're coming to the end of this call, and actually we're coming to the end of this series of calls that we've done over the COVID period. We've done about, this is the 16th of them, and we're going to take a break and come back in September. We've heard a lot of stuff that is actually quite depressing over the last few weeks, some optimism too, but I'd like to end on an optimistic note. I'd like to go to each one of the panel and say, at the end of this period, what makes you feel optimistic? Why should we feel good and not just worried about the future? So Richard, let's start with you. Richard.
I mean, look, one of the things that makes me optimistic is the thought that every person on this call is going to change their attitude towards their pensions tomorrow. So that would be one thing. I think that, there is a real understanding that investment is going to make a difference. I suppose that I would say, with my SDG hat on, there are obviously real issues there, but the fact that there is a plan, the fact that there is a deadline, the fact that thousands upon thousands of businesses are part of the global compact and wanting to do more. I actually think in terms of our idea of booting the SDGs themselves as a way that businesses can actually look in a really thorough and well-organized way at all their behaviors, I'm really hoping that that will be, that this is the right time to take an aggressive attitude to that and set ourselves these 10 years of activism and progress and understanding and enlightened business. So, you know, we were looking for a way of making it exciting, and COVID couldn't have made it more necessary. I think that's what I'd say.
Danny, a couple of sentences of optimism from you.
Yeah, I think after every great social upheaval, there tends to be this sort of dramatic change. And I think there'll be change for the better, whether that's on sustainable consumption, whether that's on thinking about social safety nets. You know, when I started this job, we published a report about care in the global economy and estimated that there, you know, unpaid care in the economy globally is about £11 trillion, three times bigger than the global IT sector. But no one ever talked about the importance of care to our society. And who would have thought 3 months into the COVID pandemic, we have a spotlight on this critical sector in which, you know, people are undervalued and underpaid. And I'm really optimistic that we use a moment like this to recalibrate a whole range of things, starting with something like care, or moving on to a whole range of other opportunities for a just recovery.
Claire.
3 points. One is, I think the fact that we're working in this way today is, you know, this amazing transformation in the way that people work, and realizing that you can still do deals, you can still build relationships, you can do the connectivity of business in a completely different way. And I think that's hugely positive, both for getting rid of the hideous hot desk concept, for example. I think will be a hugely positive thing to come out of this. So I think there's new ways of working that are very sustainable, that are good. Secondly, I think actually the focus on the value of low-waged workers, particularly in the UK economy, whether it's NHS nurses, whether it's care home workers, or whether it's delivery drivers, you know, this understanding that this whole thing holds together on the shoulders of the people who are paid least often in society, and actually understanding what our obligations and our contractual relationship looks like going forward, I think that's hugely important. And lastly, I feel a drumbeat of excitement in the business world to actually seize this opportunity that's opened up when everything's been thrown in the air. And if you're cash flow positive, to your point, Craig, about, you know, you can only think these big thoughts if you're not struggling to make payroll every month. But many businesses are in that situation. There is a real opportunity, as Richard said, to go back to what we wanted to do, which was deliver a very sustainable form of development, and really assume that Superman cape or Superwoman cape and make those things happen. Don't wait for governments to give you permission. Just get on with it.
And David, a sentence from you.
I believe the agenda items are very clearly set. We know that young people will not be patient in the way that my generation and many of us have been patient. And that's a very good thing. I chair the University of the Arts in London. We had a board meeting last night, and our students are saying we will not wait any longer. And actually, we as a board support them. So let's get on with it.
Thank you very much. Just one parish notice to say, to repeat, that this is actually going to be the last call we're going to do for a few weeks. I'd like to thank the Teneo team who've been behind this, particularly Joe Redstone, who's now giggling across from me, and Tom Simonson, but also a fantastic panel today. So thank you, Richard Curtis, Claire Perry O'Neill, David Isaac, and Danny Srishkandaraja. Please give them a virtual standing ovation, and thank you very much, and we'll see you in September.
Thank you.
Thank you
very much indeed.
Bye-bye.
Thanks a lot. Bye.